Good evening. Good evening and welcome to the Athenaeum of Philadelphia. I'm Beth Hessel, the Executive Director of the Philadelphia, and I see in our wonderful crowd a lot of members. Raise your hand if you're a member. Wonderful. And if you are a visitor, please raise your hand. Take a look around, members, and see who you want to talk to afterwards. And just to let you know, if you're warm, I turned the heat off in here, so hopefully it'll cool down. But think cool thoughts. Think about ice cubes, and we'll all cool down. Now, on the book leaf for her new book, Nancy Moses provocatively asks, what's real? What's fake? And why do we care? Her questions stir us as members and friends of the Athenaeum. We care what is real. We grapple with determining authenticity in our relationships, with historical knowledge, in current news cycles, and in the buildings and spaces that surround us in this stunning city. We know that there are both simple and guilty pleasures to be had in reproductions, as well as long-term benefits in authentic friendships and institutions and communities. Whether you are a life member of the Athenaeum or a first-time visitor, you quickly learn that this place and this community are real. We're a group of avid readers, of historians and teachers, of writers and planners, of healers and lawyers, architects, preservationists, engineers. We are activists and artists and dreamers. At the Athenaeum, we value books and artifacts, conversation groups and research opportunities. This is our authentic community, and we care that each one of us here is a part of it. And I invite you, if you're not yet a member, to see me or one of those many people who raised their hands to find out how to become a member. Welcome to the authentic Athenaeum. Now, many of you know Nancy Moses well. In fact, I had quite a few people coming to me in the last few months saying, wait, didn't she already speak on this book? And I had to say, it hasn't been released yet, so no. But we are lucky tonight to be the opening event, the first event in her speaking tour for Fakes, Forgeries, and Frauds. Nancy is at one time was executive director of the Atwater Kent, and she's held positions at the National Endowment for the Humanities and in public radio, as well as other areas. She is a doer and a thinker and an activist. She's currently the chair of the Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission and is a member here at the Athenaeum. As she said to me just now, the Athenaeum is her home, her place. Now, I was recently at a gathering of professional women who are leading change in the city, and while there, Nancy shared that after years of bugging her daughter, Nella, to write a book, Nella turned to her and said, Mom, I think that's your dream. So Nancy now has published two, and this will probably be her third, award-winning book, including Lost in the Museum and Stolen, Smuggled, Sold. So Fakes, Forgeries, and Frauds is the third book in this trilogy, and Nancy is going to share with us some of what she learned in her marvelous adventures as she researched and wrote this book. Before we invite her and welcome her up to the podium, I want to remind you that afterwards there will be a reception in Nancy's honor. Head House Books are selling books at the back of the library, so go and get yourself a cup of wine or get right in line and buy a book, and Nancy will be signing them. And please take out your phones and put them on silence before we start. And I invite you all to join me in welcoming Nancy Moses.
It's so good to see all of you here, fellow and sister members of the Athenaeum, neighbors, friends, family, girlfriends, and thank you all for coming on this cold night, and it's thank you to the Athenaeum. You have been my home away from home, a place where I do research, where I come to programs, where I pick up books and learn and love literature. So I am grateful to be here. I'm also like to introduce you to my family, Ellen Sue Moses, Myron Bloom, Nella Bloom, Bjorn Seberg, and Andrew Seberg will be coming very soon. And finally, I'd like to express gratitude to all of the Philadelphians who helped me with this book. Many are here tonight. I hope you get a chance to meet them. They are very generous and very smart. So, today what I thought I'd do is answer the question, where'd the idea come from? How did you decide to write about fakes, frauds, and forgeries? I'd introduce you to some of the chapters. Each chapter is about a different cultural treasure, and they're quite different. And finally, I hope that you all and I will talk about a question that's at the heart of the book, and maybe you'll have some ideas about helping me figure out more about why we care about these issues of authenticity so much today. How's that sound? Okay, here's what got me into the book. In the summer of 1883, a man named Moses Wilhelm Shapira, who was a respected dealer in antiques and manuscripts, traveled from his home in Jerusalem to the British Museum, which was one of his customers, and he brought along 15 fragments of a goatskin parchment inscribed with a language that's so ancient that it predated Hebrew. If it was authentic, as he thought it was, it would overturn everything that anyone had ever known about biblical scholarship, because he thought it was an early copy of Deuteronomy that predated the Bible. Shapira offered it to the British Museum for £1 million, which is $150-some million today. And the British Museum was crazy about this manuscript. They put it on display immediately. Their experts started writing scholarly papers. It was all over the newspaper, including a magazine called, conveniently, The Athenaeum. Celebrities and diplomats came from all over to see this thing, and things looked pretty good for Moses Shapira until the biblical scholars started asking questions. Who was this guy? Who was this Moses Shapira? And how could he have found these things when nobody knew about them, when the biblical scholars had never heard of them before? These parchments, they looked surprisingly new, like someone had inscribed them yesterday. And what about those Bedouin? People knew that they were in and out of those caves around the Dead Sea forever. How come these were just discovered now? The Bedouin had been going to collect guano, which was valuable as a fertilizer. So how come these things had never shown up before, these fragments? Well, those questions tipped the scales. Moses Shapira's supporters deserted him. The British Museum changed their mind. They didn't want to buy them. And Moses Shapira was shamed. He was desolate. He said he didn't think he could ever recover from this incident. He left the precious parchments at the British Museum. He got on a boat. He sailed to Rotterdam. And 6 months later, he was dead. He committed suicide. Well, that was the end of Moses Shapiro, but it wasn't the end of these manuscripts. Because some 70 years later, the next generation of British biblical scholars were at a meeting, and one of them stunned his colleagues by saying that he thought maybe Moses Shapiro's manuscripts, his parchments, could actually be authentic. What was his proof? The Dead Sea Scrolls. They had recently come out of Jerusalem. The Bedouin had found them. And all of a sudden, with the discovery of these scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls, in 1947, everything changed. The whole picture of what people thought of Moses Shapiro and his parchments changed. They looked pristine because they'd been in dry, arid, and very dark conditions for millennia. And those Bedouin, they, of course, they were in and out of those caves, but they knew the fragments were there, but they thought they were worthless. They were there for the guano. Until the British and biblical scholars started coming and asking for those little scraps of parchment, and then they became valuable. So, Moses Shapiro's story, which at first seemed so outlandish, was true, or was it? We'll never know, because the British Museum sold those fragments for practically nothing, and they were apparently, we're not totally sure, but many people think they were destroyed in a fire. So no one will ever know if Moses Shapiro was a fraudster, or whether he discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls 70 years before anybody else. When I read about this incident, I couldn't get it out of my mind. It just was shocking to me. And I couldn't figure out why it caught me so much until I realized that it opened up all of these questions about authenticity. How do we know what we think we know? Who owns the truth? What's the nature of reality anyway? So with those questions in mind, I thought, well, I'll go take a look at those subjects by looking in the world of cultural treasures. Frankly, I thought this would be an easy book to write. Things are black and white, right? They're either true or not. Well, actually, there's a lot of gray there, even with material objects. Some things that you think are real are not real. Some things are partially real and partially fake. Some things are thought to be real at one point, then they're fake again, and then they turn into real again. And some things that I think are real, other people don't think are real. So I'd like to give you some examples, if I can. Has anyone ever seen this painting? It's in the Frick. Okay, so you know it's big, and people love it because it's by Rembrandt, and it's called The Polish Rider, and they think it's very romantic. Who is this man on this horse? He's in this sort of misty, mystical landscape. Well, whether you like it or not, it's interesting on another level, as I learned when Samuel Sachs II, who's the former director of the Frick, told me that it was two-thirds Rembrandt. So I'm thinking, two-thirds Rembrandt? What's the other third? So I set out to find out. I spent a lot of time at the Frick because this particular painting there's been a lot written about it, and there's about this many files. I mean, it's vast. And then I went to Amsterdam, saw as many Rembrandts as I could, visited his house, went to The Hague, spoke to art authenticators, art restorers, art historians, and then read through everything I could find about Rembrandt and Rembrandt's times and what it was like when he was painting this painting. And so I have lots I could tell you about it, but I thought maybe you'd be most interested in knowing why it's two-thirds Rembrandt. There are three theories. The first theory is that it's two-thirds Rembrandt because somebody else painted the other third. Now, we know that at the time that Rembrandt was painting and before and after, artists often had apprentices. And those apprentices were charged often with painting parts of the painting. That might be the case with a Polish writer, except that this was painted at the end of Rembrandt's life when he was very poor. So it's not at all clear that he could have afforded to have someone working for him. So you can think what you want about that theory. Here's the second theory. The second theory, it's two-thirds Rembrandt because a third of it was never done. It was never finished. You see that lovely romantic sort of misty landscape? Well, it may be misty because it was never finished. For some reason, Rembrandt let it go out of his studio without completing the painting. There's lots of theories as to why that happened. There's a third theory. Maybe it's two-thirds Rembrandt because so much of it has been lost. Over the course of the hundreds of years since it left Rembrandt's studio, the Polish writer was packed up and moved a number of times. It was pierced, it was cut, it was repaired, repainted, relined, aggressively cleaned, and repeatedly revarnished. This painting has had a long and checkered life, but so have most paintings of this age. Most paintings of this age have had many things done to them that have materially changed them. And we have to remember that paintings are organic and they change as a matter of course. So given all this, my question to you may be, is two-thirds Rembrandt enough to count as Rembrandt, as a Rembrandt? I'm going to show you something very different now. I'd like to talk to you about fake Shakespeare manuscripts that you can actually see because they're in the Rosenbach Library and Museum, which is about a mile and a half from here. Derek Dreyer told me about these. He said that their fake Shakespeare collection is one of their most popular things they have at the Rosenbach. And how did they get to the Rosenbach? Well, as you may know, the Rosenbach Library and Museum is in Rosenbach, the house of Rosenbach, the two Rosenbach brothers, and they were the most important dealers in rare books and manuscripts in the entire country in the first half of the 20th century. And they loved Shakespeare, so they collected a lot of Shakespeare and sold Shakespeare and early important works by Shakespeare. But according to my friend Derek, Dr. Rosenbach was also somebody with a good sense of humor. And so in addition to collecting Shakespeare, he collected fake Shakespeare. And in fact, there are scholars who specialize in fake Shakespeare, including this really delightful guy named Jack Lynch, who met me at the Rosenbach, and we looked at the fake Shakespeare together. So let me tell you the story of this guy, who's named William Henry Ireland. He lived in the 1790s in London, and his father thought that he was a dolt. And William Henry wanted nothing more than to gain his father's respect. He knew his father loved Shakespeare, as did many people in 1790s in Great Britain. And he also knew there was very little that survived in Shakespeare's own hand. Very few signatures, very few documents. So being an enterprising young man, William Henry decided that he would bring his father some fake Shakespeare. So he went to an antique store and he bought some old books. He taught himself how to mix up some faded brown ink, and then he sat for a couple weeks practicing Shakespeare's signature when he should have been working. He was a law clerk. And he brings his father a wonderful treasure, which is a bill of sale with Shakespeare's signature on it. And it's for some supplies that he needed for the Globe Theater. His father is ecstatic and asks his son where he got it. And his son said, "Well, I got it from a man who is a wealthy collector of these things. And he told me that I could have it if I would never reveal his name." So, because his father was so excited, William Henry went home and did some more. He wrote a letter that Shakespeare wrote to his beloved Anne Hathaway and brought it to his father. He brought his father the manuscript for Macbeth in Shakespeare's own hand. By this time, his father has announced it to the newspapers and has started to charge people to come to his house to see these wonderful Shakespeares. And because William Henry really got into it, he presented his father with the most valuable prize of all, which was a completely new play by Shakespeare that no one had ever heard of before, called Vortigern and Rowena. His father was very enterprising too, and so he took the play out of his son's hands and ran down the street to the Drury Lane Theater, which was a theater that produced a lot of Shakespeare, and brought it to the managers. And the managers take a look at this thing, and they see it's a little dicey. The characters aren't very well developed. The script, the plot line is a little funny, but they figure, well, it's an early Shakespeare, you know, before he really could earn his chops. And if they put it on, they would make a lot of money because it would be the first Shakespeare premiere in over 200 years. William Henry writes later on, he writes an autobiography, and that's why we know a lot about what went on during this period. He's sitting in the audience, the play's being staged. He's terrified that he's going to be outed. And the curtain goes up, the actors come on, and instead of doing this great tragedy, Vortigern and Rowena, they do the play in broad farce. They can't even get through it. Everybody's laughing so hard. Because it may be that, you know, that Samuel Ireland didn't know Shakespeare, but Shakespearean actors really do. So, you know, William Henry was famous for a hot minute, and then his life was over. He couldn't get any jobs. Who would hire a lawyer that commits fraud? He tries writing more books, plays. Nobody wants to read them because they're not very good. He ends up in debtor's prison. He marries somebody, maybe, and he lives with somebody else, maybe. And so, you know, he's got to get enterprising again, and he comes up with a great plan. What he decides to do is capitalize on his moment of infamy. He decides he'll produce something rare and wonderful, a one-of-a-kind scrapbook of all of his fakes and forgeries. And he'll put them in a scrapbook along with some other Shakespeare-like things and sell them to somebody, a rich collector, for a lot of money. And that's what he did. And because that worked so well, he decided to produce another original copy and another original copy. Jack Lynch told us that he has seen 29 original letters from Shakespeare to Anne Hathaway. And this is the copy at the Rosenbach Museum and Library. So what he basically did, William Henry, was he forged his own fakes. Now, I think this is a great story. But what's even more interesting to me is the psychology of this man and the relationship between him and his father, which was really very odd. And so you may want to take a look at the book so you can learn more about this particular guy and his fake Shakespeare. The last thing I'm going to show you is something very different. I thought, in addition to writing about art objects and manuscripts, wouldn't it be fun if I could find some fake specimens? So I went to my favorite museum. Has anyone ever been to the Carnegie in Pittsburgh? Anybody grow up in Pittsburgh? Yes. My sister Ellen Sue, of course. Mom always took us to see the dinosaurs. So I went back to Pittsburgh to see the dinosaurs because in Pittsburgh there's a very good collection. This one happens to be, you see here, Diplodocus carnegie on this side, and on the other side is Apatosaurus louisa, named after Andrew Carnegie and his wife, who brought these from Utah, paid for the excavation, and built a museum around them because they couldn't fit into the museum he had. When I was a kid growing up in Pittsburgh, we were told what these were about. These are specimens. They illustrate the theory of evolution, the sciences of geology, paleobiology, and pathology, just name a few. That image is from a very different museum. It's dinosaurs, but they're very different kind of dinosaurs. They're from something called the Creation Museum in Petersburg, Kentucky. I visited there at the suggestion of two very good paleontologists who knew I was interested in fake dinosaurs. And they sent me to the right place because this particular museum has as their main motif dinosaurs. When you arrive there, it looks kind of like a natural history museum. They use all of the basic design elements that you would find in a natural history museum. But it's really not that. What it is a three-dimensional evangelical sermon. You see, and as you walk in, one of the very first things you see, like you would in a natural history museum, is a diorama. But this is a diorama of cave children cavorting with juvenile dinosaurs. And the reason is because creationists are a sect of evangelicals. The name of their ministry is Answers in Genesis, and so they believe everything in the Bible is true. And so God made the world in 6 days, 6,000 years ago, and so dinosaurs and individual people, of course, coexist. Now, you and I may have a problem with this particular brand of history and particular brand of science, and we may think it's fake science. But I have to tell you, these people are very serious about this. And it's a very interesting museum. For anyone who has any interest in museum, it definitely is a place you need to go to because they're very clever. They have a very clear message, and they know just what they're doing. What they're doing is they're arming evangelicals to counteract the argument of what they call secular science, us. And by the time you get out of that museum, you're convinced that they have a point. It may not be your point, but they do have a point of view. But if going there, I had to be very open and sort of respectful of what I was seeing there, because otherwise you miss what's going on. And I have to tell you, this is not the only creation museum in the United States. There are 40, 45 of them, not only in this country, but around the world. So, what's real? What's fake? Why do we care? Here we've seen the Creation Museum's fake dinosaurs, a Polish writer, a painting that's only two-thirds Rembrandt, Ireland's fake Shakespeare, and Moses Shapiro's real, or maybe not real, Proto-Hebraic parchments. What do they have in common? Do they have anything to tell us today? Are they relevant at all to life? Well, I think so. I think that what's real, what's fake, maybe among the most provocative and certainly the most current questions that we're asking ourselves today. In an era where you can't tell the truth from truthiness, where there's not only fake science, but fake news, where I could Photoshop images from my phone and put them on the web. People create bots. Where I was talking with somebody earlier who said he doesn't know what to believe about the coronavirus, whether it's really as virulent as people say it is. It's really very confusing. And I think that this whole thing that's so confusing to us and how uneasy we feel today about what we think of as reality and how it's being questioned is not just because of President Trump. I think it predated him, and I think it's happening all over the world. So it's in the zeitgeist somehow, right? I think we'd all agree that it is. But why? Why today? That's what's been on my mind. Where does this fascination come from, and why is it on everybody's mind today? So that's what I'd like to talk with you about and get your opinion. Thank you. So does any, yes, a young man, could you please stand up if you have a question for us?